When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mariam Zamani, and I'm an oculoplastic surgeon with a special interest in facial aesthetics and also the founder of MZ Skin. And this is the Guinea Pig Podcast. Why are we called the guinea pig?
Because that's what I am. I'm writer and journalist Fiona Goldfarb, and I'm here, ready and willing, to try out just about any treatment and treatment going. We are the breath that you take before trying anything out there. So, if you're looking for an honest, no-holds-barred approach to invasive and non-invasive cosmetic surgery,
then come join us from the clinic every Thursday on the Guinea Pig Podcast. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Guinea Pig. Once again, we're on location, and this time we've come to Mr. Patrick Malucci. Dun-dun-dun-dun.
You should see us, everybody. We've been running around London with a box with all our recording equipment, like we're on some kind of mad tour. We're running in and out of cars with our box and recording equipment, and we're interviewing experts, and here we are. Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
Haven't seen you for a while.
No, and thanks for inviting me.
Nice to be here in your own office.
Absolutely.
So we're here to talk about boobs, aren't we?
I think so. So Patrick, tell us about what you do.
My particular interest, as you probably know, is aesthetic breast surgery in all its forms. And that means both primary surgery, so people presenting for the first time, whether it's going bigger, smaller, lifting. Another big part of it is revisional surgery. So people who've already had surgery, maybe a long time ago, or maybe they're happy with their results. So a lot of it is also revisional surgery. So putting right, if you like, or improving what's already been done.
Because historically there has been so much sort of discoveries and things that are good and not good to put into one's boobs, and it's been a very long journey. So now a lot of women who've had things put in that they've had to have taken out, and I mean we're evolving in the boob world, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean the history of implants dates back to 1963.
Really?
First breast augmentation in Houston, Texas, 1963. So as you can imagine, implants have evolved tremendously over that period of time. They have never been far from controversy. There are lots of controversies which have sort of been hiccups along the way, and we're sort of traveling through one at the moment. With this phenomenon of ALCL. It's a huge topic, but way beyond the scope of this particular podcast. But I think, you know, as with all things medical, we're on alert in terms of collecting data, trying to understand what we see, and informing patients to try and be as safe as possible.
So in terms of breast implants, that seems to be a very common, you know, one of many common procedures for the breast. What are the different ways? People are always asking me, and I don't know enough about breasts, above the muscle, below the muscle. What's the difference between those two different kinds of techniques? And then if you can talk about also where the incision's made.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very simple, really. If you want a breast to look reasonably natural, you need to have good sufficient cover over that implant. You need to have enough tissue over that implant in order to disguise it as much as possible. So with those who have very little breast tissue, you inevitably go underneath their pectoralis muscle because they need a bit of extra cover over that implant. Otherwise, you're effectively putting the implant underneath the skin. So it's very visible. In those, on the other hand, who've already got a bit of breast tissue and reasonable cover, they don't have to go under the muscle because they've already got enough breast to cover that implant. Mm-hmm. So it's not a necessity for them
to go under. So a flatter-breasted woman would,
So there isn't, you know, people often think, oh, I hear one is better than the other. Both have got advantages and disadvantages, and it's really about making the right selection for the right individual. It's as simple as that.
Would you do more lifts, most of the lifts with it over the muscle then? Because I imagine a lot of those patients actually have tissue.
Again, not necessarily, because if you're you know, a very skinny mum, you've had two or three children, you've got absolutely nothing in your breasts, you're super active, you have zero
body fat.
If you're Mariam Zamani.
Oh, yes.
So I'm interested, actually. So I'm looking at Mariam, and we are Tweedledee and Tweedledum. But what Mariam has got is probably, irritatingly, the perfect smallish breast.
I'm a double D, by the way.
Are you?
I hide them.
Okay, so you hide yours.
That's
quite interesting in itself. So you would have enough, what you need between the muscle that you're talking about. I'm the layperson in this show, so I don't understand a word of anything. But the muscle comes closer to the bone, so then between the muscle and the skin there is a layer of fat, in
absolutely.
My case,
or breast tissue. That's
or
right.
Breast tissue.
So if you think about it in terms of layers, if you're working from the outside inwards, you've got your skin on the outside, then you've got a little bit of fat and breast tissue, and then that sits on top of the muscle, and then the muscle.
So for most women who have a bit of breast, you wouldn't have to go under the muscle.
And the thing that's really interesting about that, the thing that's really changed our practice, is that if you don't go under the muscle, because it's a less invasive procedure, we now don't do it under general anaesthetic. So we do that under sedation.
Wow.
Which is
amazing.
Phenomenal. Because on average, people are dressed and go home about an hour to an hour and a half after their surgery. They're dressed and walking home. So it is...
How long is that procedure?
The procedure takes about an hour.
But you're then in a sort of sports bra type situation?
Yeah, you have a light dressing or in a sports bra.
For how long?
Usually for a couple of weeks during the healing process. And once the dressings come off, my general advice is that they can wear whatever's comfortable.
So augmentation is a walk in the park compared to what I really want, which is reduction.
Yeah, I mean, reduction is a more intricate, a little bit more complex procedure. It's different to breast augmentation. Ironically, although it's a more complicated, slightly longer procedure, it's often less uncomfortable than the augmentation.
Really?
Because when you're expanding a breast, and sometimes that's quite uncomfortable, but actually the reduction is a kind of a relieving operation, so you're taking weight away, and it's not that... it's not that uncomfortable.
But it's more scarring.
It is more scarring, yes.
So for an augmentation, what are the different areas where you can have a scar now?
So generally, the preferred incision today, for a whole bunch of reasons, is the incision in the fold of the breast. It's the cleanest incision. And when I say clean, I mean less bacterial contamination, which is a real... key aspect of breast augmentation, because if you go through the nipple, through the armpit, then your bacterial load and contamination is much higher, and that has consequences down the road. And the other thing with the incision in the fold of the breast is it's the best access to the breast. You can do all your revision surgery through that.
Do you mean the fold of the breast, again, layperson, is where we used to put a pencil?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why would you put a pencil there?
Because you did the pencil test when you were at school to see if your boobs were high enough so that if they could hold a pencil, they were too saggy. They were too low.
Wow.
But if the pencil didn't, is that right? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the idea
is... pencil test was how high your boobs are.
Yes. You
needed to go to British school. That's how we educated ourselves.
You want to fail the pencil test.
You want to fail the pencil test. It's the only test you really want to fail.
And then what about going through the belly button?
No, that's just a gimmick for saline implants. Just not done. It used to go by the synonym of tuba, trans-umbilical breast augmentation, but that's
out of fashion.
And what about Marianne's favourite, the fat implants?
What do you think about fat transfer augmentation?
So fat transfer, and we do a lot of fat transfer all the time. To do pure fat transfer for breast augmentation is an unusual procedure because few people are good candidates for that.
Well, not so much for augmentation, but, you know, so after you've had children and the top portion of your breasts becomes a little bit more empty, not for an augmentation, but to sort of improve the skin quality there so that you're not seeing a little excess skin.
Yeah, so fat is used in many situations. It can be used with implants, so-called composite breast augmentation. So the idea is that you use a little bit less implant and you add a bit of fat. In other words, the less foreign body you've got, you know, the better, the more natural. So that's one way of using fat. We quite often will combine fat with, for example, a breast lift, where there's been a little bit of loss of volume at the top of the breast. Maybe not quite the necessity for an implant, but the idea of embellishing what you have with a bit of fat is also a very attractive option. And we also use it for things like asymmetries, where one breast is different to the other. Rather than using different implants, you might use the same implant but make up the difference with fat. And you can also use it for people who've got naturally wide breasts and a wide cleavage. You can try and soften the cleavage area by specifically targeting that area with fat. So there are lots of situations in which we can use it.
Another idiot question, sorry. So I have a friend who is really properly, completely flat-chested. She was told it was a hormonal thing, that she had failed to hormonally develop in some way. Tell us a little bit about that.
So that condition is called amastia, which mm-hmm. basically means that you don't have breast development. And we see people from time to time. But again, you know, with an appropriately selected implant, most often suited to teardrop shaped implant, which are naturally more breast shaped and more natural, you know, you can get excellent results.
And it's not something that could be treated with hormones or
no.
It's just
once you've missed the hormonal sort of development spurt, you won't get it back.
And then what about in those who've had a history of breast cancer? I mean, what do you recommend in someone like that? Do you recommend more going down the fat route or an implant route? Or, you know, what does that mean for imaging of breasts later on with mammography?
I mean, it's a complicated question because it depends very much on the nature of the breast cancer, the treatment, and what reconstruction, you know, those individuals have had carried out in them. So there's a whole host of ways of treating them, whether it's with implants, with fat, using different parts of the body, etc., etc. So it very much depends on the circumstance, basically.
And then what about for imaging?
Imaging is very important, of course. And I'll mention something about a relatively new development. But,
sorry, what do you mean by imaging?
So when you go for a mammogram, I mean, I know, for instance, Patrick has a ultrasound here, which I assume you do for your patients pre-surgery.
Exactly. So I was going to say, all of our patients, whatever breast surgery you're having, have preoperative ultrasound. Mm-hmm. We have a consultant radiologist from the Royal Marsden breast unit who does all our scanning. If he feels there's further indication for mammography or MRI, then he can do that, and we take his advice on that. But it's a very good way of screening people prior to surgery before you change the environment. One of the interesting developments in implants to do with screening is this new generation of slightly lighter weight implants, so-called B-light implants. And these were developed by an Israeli company. They've been acquired by a big German implant company. They've been around for about probably 8 years or so. And they're 30% lighter than standard silicone. And the way they do this is that the silicone has these tiny little microspheres, which are air-filled, bound to the silicone. So it's a little bit like an aero. Or a Malteser, if you think of a cross-sectional Malteser.
I love the idea of having a Malteser-like boob.
But what's really interesting about these implants is not only are they lightweight and all the obvious benefits of that, but they're also much more translucent. So, for example, you know, in breast cancer patients, the idea of imaging and following up is quite attractive, potentially with this new generation
because
of implants.
Because you can see
what you're doing. Yeah, you can see much better.
So incredible. My mother, well, I always end up talking about my mother, but my mother had a friend, I remember when I was a child, who'd had her boobs done, and it was like touching a crash helmet. I mean, it's so incredible how far it's come,
yeah,
and what can be done.
And then what determines whether someone has like an encapsulation or like why do those things happen? I have a few plastic surgery friends who I follow.
What is an encapsulation?
In the States, and I will let Patrick say that because okay. I do not want to mess up what that actually means. But I see these horrific images of implants and...
Yeah, so I mean, so... encapsulation or capsular contracture, as it's known, is effectively scar tissue which forms around the implant. But it's scar tissue which thickens and contracts. And in so doing, it makes the implant very hard, it distorts it, and it makes it very unattractive in shape. Now, there are some things that we do understand about capsular contracture. So bacterial contamination... but bacterial contamination is a big contributing factor. So there are certain steps and maneuvers that we take in the operating theatre to minimise contamination. So the introduction of the so-called no-touch technique, nobody touches the implant, we seal the nipples off, we have a special funnel which delivers the implant into the breast without anybody touching it. And a whole bunch of other manoeuvres, including cleaning of the breast pockets, antibacterial solutions, to try and counter that. And we know that good surgical technique has radically reduced the rate of capsular contracture. Doesn't eliminate it, but certainly, you know, maybe 20 years ago, capsular contracture rates were 25, 30, 40%.
Wow.
You know, now they're down to sort of, 5% and less. Yeah.
And then you said taping of the... Why the nipples? Why is the nipples
because
so filled
because
with...
Because, again, the nipples through the milk ducts, leak bacteria.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Definitely don't like the idea of leaking bacteria there.
Yeah, tape them up.
And then, actually, you're also known for your ratio. Can you tell us a little bit about your ratio? Which is nicely on the wall. Have you seen it, Fee?
No, yeah. Is that his success rate?
I hope not. Because it's 45, 55.
Just checking. I'm booking in.
No, I mean, look, the whole thing of the ratio is, I set out a few years ago to try and understand what an attractive breast was. The reason for doing that is if you're going to, operate someone, if you're going to change something, if you're going to try and correct something, you have to try and understand what it is you're trying to achieve. And it's really, breast augmentation for many years has had a sort of bad reputation about just being about volume, just shoving a bit of volume in there. And we all know those images of the 1980s of Pamela Anderson and Katie Price and, these are not attractive breasts. They are big, distorted. So it was really trying to understand, volume itself is not sufficient to create attractiveness. And actually it's about volume distribution or shape. And this is really what led me to understand about volume proportions in the breast in order to try and create a naturally attractive breast. The ratio, which is now... pretty much recognized worldwide, is something known as the 45-55 ratio. And what this looks at is the relative volume above the nipple and below it. So if you imagine a breast in its profile and you draw a horizontal line through the nipple, a naturally attractive breast has actually got a little bit more volume below it than it does above. So it's got that nice fullness of the lower pole. And when you get that volume distribution, you get three other things. The nipple naturally angulates skywards slightly, so that's number two feature. The lower pole curvature is a tight convex curve. It's not floppy, it's not too straight, it's a nice tight convex curve. And then what's known as the upper pole slope is generally pretty much a straight line or a very mild concave line. And effectively, if you have those features, you have a naturally attractive breast. So you can then use this template around which to design and plan your surgery. And that's really the significance of it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So do you, so I keep imagining you wandering around art galleries actually looking at beautiful nudes, but although yeah. I have a great friend who did have her breasts done and she took Dejeuner sur l'herbe to the plastic surgeon and she said, can I have those? So I think yeah. it does actually, to me in a way, it does make sense. If yeah. you look at beautiful art and you look at beautiful sculpture, yeah. then you understand what maybe the definition of a beautiful breast is or a shape. Do you show your patients the 3D possibilities of what their breasts can be?
No, I don't actually. I don't, because I don't think it works very well.
Okay.
I started doing it and
I remember you started quite a number of years ago and you fell.
And you know, the problem is that you take the before picture, you plug in the implants and look at the after image, and I just look at it and think, oh my God, I can't show her that. You know, that's awful. You know, I know I can do much better than that, and it doesn't look anything like what I'm trying to produce. So, you know, although the idea is an attractive idea, the images, it's just not good enough. So actually, you know, I tend to just show patients, you know, real before and after images of, you know, perhaps similar individuals or similar situations to say, look, you know, this isn't new, but this is kind of close to where you are. This is what we were like before. This is what we're like afterwards. This is where I think you're going to be. And I think that's more informative.
So many things aren't kind to breasts. So many things like childbirth, or we've talked about this before, menopause,
gravity.
Well, you know, my children saying, mummy, why are your bosom so long? And I'm, you know, I hit them very hard. But also things like, you know, well, menopause, when you start, we've talked about this before, you get back breasts and front breasts. You know, you get really extraordinary things kind of popping up all over your body that you're just not prepared for. Sudden folds around the waist and but particularly on the back, around the back of the bra strap and things. So is there a sort of, for you, would you say to a woman of a certain age, is there a sort of don't bother cut off age, or a,
how, do you know what horrible, I mean? No, but I mean, there's it. No cut off
about
age.
This before. You know what, I'm in my late 50s and I'm like, if I was to put myself through what I'd have to go through to have the bosoms of my dreams, which, you know, Mariam, I would in a heartbeat, but is it really like the thickening of the body is such a strange thing anyway?
Of course,
so
it is,
what happens to the breasts is very particular. They start growing out my armpits. I mean, it's not great.
No, look, there's never a, you know, never say never. Absolutely not. And actually, if you're fit and well, age is absolutely irrelevant.
Really? So you could be in your 70s and decide to get your boobs.
Listen, let me tell you, I was going to tell you a story of a 79-year-old.
You go right ahead.
Who came to see us, you know, a couple of years ago. 79 years, she walked in, I said, and you know, how can I help you, Mrs. Jones? And she said, I'd like a breast augmentation.
My boyfriend insists.
You know, and it's very difficult because I found myself looking for, you know, are you sure you don't have blood
mm-hmm.
pressure?
Mm-hmm.
You're sure your heart's okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you're sure your kidneys work? So I was looking for excuses not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But she was as fit as a fiddle. You know, she looked great. She just wanted to look good in her dresses. You know, can you really say to somebody, sorry, you're too old?
No.
I mean, you can't.
Can you say to somebody, sorry, you're too young?
Yeah, well, that you can do, yes.
Because there's a lot of that. I think we talk about it endlessly on this show, you know, the
you can,
Instagram.
And that's very different.
Mm.
But to go back to your...
My menopausal mess.
I mean, one of the things... that where we obviously try and evolve as well and try and improve is, you know, the big enemies, if you like, are gravity and skin elasticity. They're two fights which are difficult to conquer. But one of the things that we use now, particularly in our breast lifts and our breast reductions where gravity is an issue, is I routinely use what's known as a mesh, which is, it's almost like an internal bra. And it's like a piece of netting, which is there to try and help prop things up. So, you know, we recognize...
I'm literally holding, cupping and holding up.
The mesh pretty much sits where your hand does.
Where my hand is.
So it's in the lower pole of the breast?
It's in the lower pole of the breast.
How does it stay there?
It gets sutured to the to the tissues at the lower pole.
What's it made of, this
mesh? It's a biologically derived synthetic mesh, which is very attractive because it basically gets degraded by your body over a two-year period. It gets converted to collagen, which in itself has got tensile strength. So the attractive thing is it's there for the reforming part of the healing process, but it's not a foreign body because eventually it gets converted to your own collagen, and that's what makes it, you know, very attractive. A lot of people don't like the idea of having, you know, a foreign body in them, and so this is only a temporary foreign body. But we now use that routinely.
Is that work like a sort of? I wanted to ask about threads as well, or because people are so kind of mixed. Can you use threads to lift your breast?
Not the breast. No.
Not really. I kind of thought I'd have my nipples threaded and then attach it to my earrings. I could wind them up. Yeah. I have this vision of being able to sort of thread.
So hard.
Thread.
I like the idea.
I thought I'd be a bit of an inventor. You can have the patient. Honestly, it's yours.
Yeah, painful. Yeah.
Very depressing. Having yesterday, I was on. I was on a shoot. I was working, I said, your boobs have got so big. And it's some people, it's what they live for. But it's, for me, I was completely depressed. You know, I was just like, I don't want to have huge boobs. I really don't. I had lovely boobs, just a handful, for half of my life. And now I've got these matronly things.
So for scarring, for a reduction, for instance, that's one of the things that people are worried about the most with a reduction. How can you reduce, is there anything that can be done to decrease your scarring? Is there a technique that's involved with it? Is it the type of suture that's used? Or is it just the volume of how much is removed?
You have like one, two, three, you have a scarf from the lollipop to the nipple.
So I think it's a really good question because the first thing people say is, I don't want scarring.
Yeah.
I don't want scarring. But my analogy is that this is a tailoring exercise where my cloth is your skin, effectively. Yeah. And the scars are the seams of my tailoring.
Oh, I like that.
Okay. Now, no scars equals no change.
Okay.
Now, in general, people will forgive the scarring, forgive any scarring for a beautiful shape. You know, you will forgive the presence of scarring if you have a beautifully shaped breast. Because, you know, an unattractive breast is unattractive whether it's got scars or no scars. So, you know, as soon as you try and, you know, relate these concepts to people, they start to see them. And I show them loads of pictures. I say, look, this is a lady with droopy breasts. She's got no scars. This is her afterwards. She's full of scars.
And you know, I mean, realistically, they are in a bra for most of us most of the time. So it's not like they're, you know, I'm not walking down the road with them out.
Yeah, but the point is that often the idea of having your lift or your reduction is that you might have the freedom not to wear a bra. As you know, unlikely as that may seem to you, but that is a reality. So I think understanding why you've got scars, and I talk about scars beneficially. Scars allow me to shape the breast. They allow me to create something attractive. There is nothing to be gained by avoiding scars if it doesn't allow me to create shape.
This is true. And anything the person, the patient
the
can
Alexander
do to
McQueen of the breast world. Isn't he? He's the Alexander McQueen.
So, I mean, there are lots of things that you can do for scars, including, you know, sort of topical application of silicone-based creams, there are silicone tapes, you can simply paper tape. There are lots of, you know, we introduce laser for our scars at 3 weeks after surgery. So the idea is that rather than trying to make a bad scar good, you try and influence the healing environment from the get-go. So, you know, there are lots of things that you can do to try and reduce scars. Having said all that, there are those who will always scar beautifully and those who, whatever you do, won't scar well. And that's just, you know, the nature of us as human beings.
Urban myth. If you wear your bra to bed, is that a good thing to do? My mother used to say, go to sleep in your bra and then you won't, your boobs won't drop.
Yeah.
So did my mom.
So you see?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's...
Okay,
yeah.
Just needed to clear that up with an expert.
Yeah.
The M&S trainer bra when I was 11.
Yeah. I used to say there was this book, Hello God, It's Me, Margaret, or something, and it said, I must increase my bust. And my husband always laughs, and he said he must have said that a lot. So I just wanted to bring up also, you've done a lot, you do a lot of reconstructive work. So I think that's a part that sort of gets lost in the whole scope of breast augmentation, reduction. So there are a lot of people who unfortunately sometimes go to places that are maybe financially less expensive and end up with, you know, issues, or they go to somebody who's not necessarily trained in that specific procedure. How do you assess somebody who has had something go wrong? Because the breasts are very traumatizing for a woman. You know, you wear a lot of clothes. It's in your profile in terms of your silhouette. If you're wearing anything that might have, you know, a little low cut, you can see it. It's, while you can cover some things and you can use padded bras, it can be very... I don't know what the word is.
It can be distressing.
No, yeah. Just to see yourself naked at any time you go take a shower.
I mean, look, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why things go wrong or outcomes are poor. And it can be from poor implant selection to begin with. You know, the wrong shape, the wrong size, put in the wrong place. It can be, you know, inadequate lifting, you know, sort of half-done procedures.
Mm.
And it's very interesting how younger, inexperienced surgeons are often quite overawed by demanding patients. So quite often, you know, we'll go back to the scarring. The first thing a patient will say is, well, I don't want any scars. And the young, inexperienced surgeon will think, okay, I've got to do this without scars. So he goes and does the surgery and it looks awful. And then she comes to me or whoever else she goes to with a very poor result. But that's the cycle that they've got into, is there's been poor decision making along the way. So,
interesting.
In order to avoid these issues, it is all about the decision algorithm. And then when they come to see me, it's about trying to undo that algorithm.
Because a lot of people don't know the questions to ask. I think that's the thing. They come to see you and they know they want something different, but they're not sure what
course.
It is. And so would you give any advice to people who are sort of setting out on a journey for either reduction or enhancement? Mm. Questions that are kind of good places to research before they come and see a doctor?
Look, I think, you know, it's the standard advice. You know, make sure that you're going to a bona fide surgeon, that he or she are members of the various organisations, so the British Association of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, the BARPS, or the BAPRAS. And, you know, go and see more than one person. That's the other thing.
Yes.
You know, you will very quickly...
Second opinion is very important.
I always talk about patients being very good at smelling experience, certainty, decisiveness, or the opposite. You know, they're very good at smelling out someone who's not very certain about what they're saying or delivering. So I think it's very important to see a couple of people, three people, whatever it is. Don't see too many, because then you start getting confused.
Yeah.
Select those individuals, go and see them, and then you'll suddenly understand the person that you feel, you know, understands you best and is making most sense.
I also wanted to ask you, in terms of revisions, is it difficult to remove a breast implant?
It's not difficult to remove a breast implant. The question is what you do after that.
Yes.
And again, that's a completely individual
decision,
because there are those who've got quite a bit of breast tissue and actually after a few years say, you know what, I've got plenty of breast, I don't need the implants. And often you'll take the implants out, maybe do a lift at the same time just to sort of improve the overall shape. Or sometimes those who really have got virtually nothing will often downsize their implant significantly and carry out a lift in order to improve the shape.
And then the other question, this is maybe myth busting, how often do you need to change an implant? I mean, is it, I always remember hearing every 10 years you need to change the implant. Has that changed now?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the sort of figure that's bandied around. There is no sell-by date on implants. So in theory, an implant could last forever, in theory. There are a number of reasons, however, that lead people to change their implants. So either there's a problem with the implant itself, it can break, it can rupture, it can go hard. We talked about capsular contracture. Or quite often over time, the look changes.
Yes. Mm.
People gain weight, they lose weight, the breasts have dropped. You know, that's another reason to seek surgery.
Mm.
And so on average, about 50% of people will be back for one of those reasons at about 10 or 12 years.
Interesting. So it's not so much the implant, it's all the other things that associated with it.
Potentially.
I was going to ask the $6 million question.
Oh, yeah?
Is it $6 million?
It should be.
I think we ought to talk about, roughly, and I know you're the surgeon, so you'll say, I don't know, somebody sends the bills, but where are we looking at for breast, let's say, augmentation or even reduction? Just for our listeners.
Well, I mean, the thing is that there isn't one answer to that question. So, you know, is there a
ball
spectrum.
In a park?
I mean, I think you could probably get it done somewhere between £5,000 and £10,000.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, something like that. Lower end is 5,000, okay. The higher end is closer to 10.
Okay. Thank you for
12,
that.
If you come to me.
Thank you. He's got very nice hands, by the way.
He does.
Everybody,
I was
he's got the most fantastic hands.
Too.
I think I'd be very happy to have my boobs in those hands.
You do.
Wouldn't you, Mariam?
Anytime.
They've just got a very, they've got, yes. Well,
no, but you do have very nice hands. I was wondering if you got a manicure. Nice.
Thank you. No, I have not.
You had a manicure for the podcast. But I do think, yes, but they would be very, very reassuring.
They'd be welcome.
They'd be welcome anytime, honestly. I mean, sorry, Robert, if you're listening, but he has got very nice hands.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that you think we should
would you like
tell?
To ask us?
Yeah. Tell our audience.
I mean, just really going back to the hands.
The hands are, you'd be in good hands with Patrick.
Yeah.
I've actually
hands.
Seen a lot of his surgeries and his outcomes. So that's why he is specifically on our podcast.
Have you been in and watched him?
I have been on the tail end of some cases, just, you know, coming
snooping.
In.
Snooping around, that's Mariam.
Snooping, because we used to, you know, share a penthouse suite where I work from now.
Before I deserted her.
That's all we have time
thanks,
for
Patrick,
today.
Lovely to see you. Thank you for making time for us, because I know you're the most in-demand
so
boob man in town. So,
my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
The Guinea Pig provides unbiased information to those who may be considering cosmetic surgery or even trialing a non-invasive treatment or product. We do not endorse the use of any product or procedure featured in this podcast and are not responsible for the outcome of any of the treatments featured on this podcast or damage caused in connection with any treatments or products. Should you decide to try any of the procedures, treatments or products mentioned in any episode of The Guinea Pig, you do so at your own risk. Always consult an independent and fully qualified medical professional if you are considering embarking on a medical procedure, irrespective of whether it's an invasive or non-invasive procedure.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.